And you probably never hear me say that again in terms of providing information to the board, because I think normally we want to push out as much as we possibly can. In this particular situation, probably should not have turned over some of that. In the future, if we would, and I hope we don't ever have to deal with this again, but in the future, if that occurs, the things that I would provide are, number one, the verified complaint if one is filed, an answer if one is filed, and those, that, by the way, is not required, and any memo that Corporation Counsel would do, like he did in this last one, that lays out the procedure and the various considerations. And that would basically be it. In this last proceeding, I sent out to you, for example, one particular thing that I should not have, which was Mr. Grennison's memo. Mr. Grennison's memo, first of all, it had some problems of its own. It contained outdated cases, ones that had been overruled by later cases, outdated attorney general's opinions that were interpreting statutes that are not even in existence today, other inadmissible information that the court would not have allowed in terms of rules of evidence. I think what that did was that caused a lot of confusion on the board in terms of, well, what are the rules we're supposed to follow? That's the type of a document that would get sent to the judge. And both sides would give that kind of information to the judge and say, here is our interpretation of the law. And the judge reads it, this one, the judge reads that one, maybe does his own research and issues a ruling saying, here is what the law is. Here are the rules that you have to follow. The jury never hears any of that. Those types of arguments and deliberations occur outside a jury, before the jury is even selected, in fact, where those rules are laid out. And the jury is not part of that, so that if somebody makes an argument that this is relevant and the jury should hear this and the judge says no, they never do have a chance to hear that. And so, you know, in that regard, we did our own what we called kind of a pretrial conference where Judge Mulroy met with the two attorneys, Mr. Grennison and Mr. Belzer, also met with our corporation counsel, and then myself and Tara Johnson. And we talked about, or I should say mainly they talked about, what are the rules that apply here? And that was what the judge decided then in terms of here, and what he read to you that night in terms of here are the parameters of what you can base your decision upon. And as part of that meeting, we asked Mr. Shepard, or the judge asked Mr. Shepard, to write out those jury instructions. I'm going to ask Bill to address that a little bit.
I think that one thing that you should recognize is that, and you probably already do, that this is a very unusual procedure. I checked with the attorney for the WCA. He had had two cases like this. Neither had gone to a hearing. I got an email last week from the Corporation Counsel and in another county, in Barron County, about discipline of a supervisor. He didn't know what to do. So I responded back to what our procedure was. I got a response back from the Dane County Corporation Counsel, basically saying they had a similar kind of problem. They didn't know what to do, but the Corporation Counsel in Dane County felt that our procedure was a good one. So what we were kind of going through a process that that isn't well laid out. We had the statute, and 17.16 is a statute that talks about some of the things about a verified complaint and so forth that Steve has already mentioned. We felt at the outset that one of the main requirements for this process, and this has been interpreted in a Supreme Court case, is that the accused be provided with due process. And so that was our intent from the very outset, to provide for due process, which means that he had a fair opportunity to be heard, to be represented by counsel, to have an impartial and unbiased jury, in effect, make a decision on this case. And we felt that the best way to do that was to engage a retired judge. And I think that was a very good step. And he could call and make the rulings without having to worry about political affiliations or any other kinds of things that might creep into this kind of hearing. So to get to the jury instructions, when we met with the judge, one of the decisions that that all parties agreed to was we would conduct this like a trial. That it was felt that and agreed to by both sides that that was the fairest thing to do, that the judge would apply the rules of evidence, and you saw him make some evidentiary rulings, and that he would give you instructions based on the law. And so I wrote, with Dave Lang's help, the jury instructions. I use the word jury instructions in the it was really instructions to you, of course. And this was really based on a form jury instruction, which were modified to be more applicable to the circumstances of this hearing. This was provided to all both counsel before we met on December 18th. And in fact, Mr. Grennison wrote back and said that he wanted two things. Basically, he wanted the definition of cause, which was in the statutes, and he wanted something else about fraud. And he'd given a definition from Black's Law Dictionary, which is a legal dictionary that lawyers use when they can't find a case that defines something adequately. So taking those suggestions, I incorporated both of those into the jury instruction. Those then were presented to all parties, and we met while you were engaged in the zoning business the night of the hearing. And there were no arguments or questions about the jury instructions as were amended, and it was accepted by the judge and both attorneys. So what you heard then was agreeable to the parties. They did not contest them or raise further objections. So I think that they were as fair as we could make them. I've recently gotten a letter from Mr. Grennison raising some of the same things that were in his opinion or memo that you got way back when. But those concerns were not presented to the judge as a part of the jury instructions now. I think that the jury instructions was an accurate summary of the law, and the judge agreed, and the parties did not disagree. So that's what you heard.
And now that the board has made a decision, I can be much more free in telling you about what happened leading up to actually having that hearing. And some of this you know, some of this you may not know. It started out with J.C. Gamroth contacted me in probably late summer, early fall, and she indicated that she knew of a person who was upset that Mr. Erickson did not live in his district. That person was not her. The person obviously turned out to be Kyle O'Brien. She also mentioned that it was fairly common knowledge on campus that Mr. Erickson was not living in his district, and he was pretty flagrant in bragging that he was not going to get caught and so forth. My recommendation, and you heard the testimony as to that, to JC was to tell Mr. O'Brien, send your letter or send a letter of complaint to the special prosecutor. Okay, he did that. Unfortunately, he also sent a letter to me saying, hey, I have this complaint. Now, at that point, it was a letter of complaint. It was not a verified complaint, and there's a significant distinction in that regard, and I want to talk about that. My initial reaction when I got his complaint letter was to refer the matter to the Ethics Committee. The concern I had at that point, however, is that that would make it a public issue. And I was aware that there could be a very innocuous explanation as to why he happened to be above Mr. O'Brien's apartment all the time. For example, maybe his girlfriend lived there and he simply visited her a lot. So before we turned this into a very nasty and very public airing of laundry, I wanted to see if there was something that could be done that could resolve this one way or another without turning it into that type of a thing. On the other hand, ethically, as a county board chair, I can't get a letter like that and simply say, I'm going to set it aside. I felt an obligation that if a citizen is complaining to me about something, it needs to be looked into. So I talked to Mr. Shepherd, and it was his suggestion, and I think it was an excellent one, that we contact the Sheriff's Department to ask them to do an investigation. And I then asked Bill to make that request of the Sheriff's Department for two main reasons. Number one, if the investigation determined that there was no merit to the allegations, then I could explain their findings to Mr. O'Brien, see if he was willing to withdraw his complaint, and we're done. We move on. Secondly, if the investigation determined that there was merit, I intended to share that report with Mr. Erickson and give him the option of what he would do at that point, resign, fight it, whatever the case may be. If he chose to resign, he could simply say, I've got new priorities in my life, I'm resigning, and that would be the end of it. There wouldn't have to be any sort of allegation that anything was done wrong or whatever the case may be. As you know, obviously, the investigation did find merit, and I presented that report to both parties, both to Mr. O'Brien and to Mr. Erickson directly. I advised Mr. Erickson before he made any decisions after reading that report, he needed to talk to his attorney. I said, one of the things that you need to keep in mind is you are facing a criminal investigation that is not part of this, and is not controlled by this. However, in years past, I used to practice criminal law, and I know that in his particular situation, if it appeared to the special prosecutor that there was just cause in going forward in the criminal charge, the best card that Mr. Erickson had to play was being on the board or not being on the board. And I said, you know, if you decide that you're going to resign, don't lose that card. Talk to your attorney, and he can talk to the special prosecutor about how about if I resign, will this whole criminal thing go away? I gave him that advice, and I think that was very good advice, and I hope that he had that discussion with his attorney. I also said, take a couple days, don't make a decision now. Talk to your attorney, let me know. This was Monday, as you recall, of the budget meeting week. We were meeting again on Wednesday. I said, let me know at the beginning of the meeting on Wednesday what it is you decide to do. I also asked Mr. O'Brien's attorney, give him a couple days, let him make the decision before our hell breaks loose and we go into this next phase. And he agreed that he would give them until Wednesday. And Mr. Erickson chose not to resign. And then at that point, Mr. Belzer filed that verified complaint. And the day that I announced that situation to the board was that afternoon. Very significant point in the process. From the time that we received that verified complaint, the board nor myself no longer had any discretion as to whether we were going to deal with that issue or not. The law is very clear what happens at that point. And there were two things that people have asked about. Couldn't we have done this? Couldn't we have sent it to the Ethics Committee? Couldn't we have sent this to the Executive Committee? And I asked both of those questions of Mr. Shepherd, and I'm going to ask him to explain to the board the dilemma that we faced in that regard.
Okay. I'm sure that most of you have had a chance to review this little green booklet. If you haven't, it's worthwhile looking at again. And this is the Code of Ethics in pamphlet form. It's also in the our code. You can look at it online, section 2.04 of our county code. But it really deals with more of a conflict of interest, receiving money or benefits that aren't available to the public in general. So it really doesn't address the issues that were raised in the verified complaint by Mr. O'Brien. My first review was of this code and to see if there was any reference in the code to the state statutes that we were dealing with. Namely 17.16, which talks about the removal of a supervisor. In subsection 9 of the Code of Ethics, there's compliance with state statutes. It really talks about other statutes, not the one that was the issue in this case. So the other thing that I looked at was, of course, the case law interpreting 17.16. And there is a Supreme Court case, I've mentioned it in reference to the other issue, that came out of I think, the city of Franklin, I think that's down by Milwaukee someplace, and this case went up to the Supreme Court. It talked a lot about due process, but the Supreme Court made it very clear that the body designated to conduct the hearing and which has the removing authority is the appropriate body to handle this kind of matter. And in our case, in that case, it was the city of Franklin, their common council. In this case, obviously, it's the county board, since we're dealing with a county board supervisor. 17.16 talks about the removing power, which we often state in terms of the removing authority, but both meaning the same thing, that only the body has the authority to do to remove a supervisor, and this would be the same with other governmental entities. So it was my determination, my advice to Mr. Doyle, that neither the ethics board or any committee of the county board would be appropriate, that this thing needed to go directly to the county board. And again, following the procedures of 17.16, that's what was done.
The other option that was not an option was to simply do nothing and to simply pass on it. If we would in the future at some point receive a verified complaint that we believed was frivolous, the most that we could do would be to require that the person bringing that complaint post a bond that would essentially, in the event that it was finally after a trial was determined to be frivolous, could be used to pay for the costs that the county incurred, such as the court reporter, payment of the judge, and that type of thing. But that's the most that we could do, is to simply say, if you want to go forward with this, we got to let you, but you're going to put up a bond in case we determined that this was an off-the-wall type of a thing. Now, that standard is actually fairly low in the beginning in terms of when the person files the complaint, that's not, you know, guilty beyond a reasonable doubt type of standard at that point. It is, is there enough credible evidence to justify going forward? And clearly in this particular case, when you have an eyewitness and you have people who are giving their explanation of what they saw, it was, you know, ultimately an issue to be determined by the board, but did not appear to be frivolous. So there's also been some questions that were raised to a little bit. I know Mr. Geary raised some at the deliberation that were ruled as not appropriate for the deliberation. And I agree with for the deliberation, they weren't appropriate to be talked about. But I also agree that because this is a legislative body and perception is also important for us, that it be important that we look at how we handle these types of situations and are we being fair. Even though this was thrust upon us, were we being fair compared to other people? The three examples of people that I have heard mentioned before in terms of, well, what about them? I want to talk about each of them. The first one would be J.C. Gamroth. What about the fact that J.C. did not live in her district for part of the time? In that particular case, when I first appointed J.C. to the board, she lived in a dorm, and the dorms in La Crosse are closed over the summer. So she had no option but to move out of the district to Bangor, I believe, is where she moved to, with the intent to move back to a specific address in the fall. So clearly that is the type of thing where the statute envisions you are in a district and you leave knowing that you're going to come back. You're on a vacation or you're on a trip or whatever. So that was the first one. The second example was Luke Nagley, who is, and all of these, by the way, are student representatives. Luke Nagley was elected the year that I became chair. And I couldn't remember the details of that one until I asked Marion to look it up and tell me when it was that he had left and when he came back. And so she pulled out the minutes, and then I checked my calendar, and it jogged my memory. Luke and I met shortly before the semester started, probably sometime in late August of that year, and he indicated that he had an opportunity to do some studying as part of the university over in the Middle East, and he wanted to do it that semester. He would be gone in his anticipation September, October, and November, but should be back in time for the December county board meeting. I indicated to him that that was his call. It was not a decision that I could make and kick him off the board or anything, and wished him well. He contacted me again by email late in that school semester. We met right around Christmas time at Fazy's restaurant, and he said, I decided I'm going to stay there another semester, and at that point I indicated, so what you're telling me is you're getting off the board, right? And he said, yeah. So did I push him off the board, or did he make his own decision, or did I help him? I don't know, but I mean, at that point, it was a little bit more extensive than simply, I'm going to be gone for a couple months, but I'm going to be back. And so I think he made the right decision, and he resigned, and I appointed a replacement in that particular case. Third example, John Linder. Many of you don't remember John Linder. He was elected to the board 1988. It was in my second term. At one point, Mr. Linder was running a political campaign in another part of the state and was gone for a period of time. I thought that was kind of appalling, but I asked the clerk's office to give me the records on that, and interestingly, he only missed, he only missed two meetings as a result of that. It must have been a special election in the spring, because he missed the February and the March meeting. Other than that, it was sporadic that he had missed, but he was mainly here. And so I didn't like it, but I was fairly new to the board, and nobody did anything about it. So, I mean, I guess that one's water over the bridge. But again, probably would not meet the standard that the statute requires. All of those three, regardless of how you interpret them and how you compare them to Mr. Erickson, have one huge, huge difference between their case and his case. And that huge difference, the critical difference, is in their cases, nobody filed a complaint. That verified complaint filed by a private citizen to the county board changed everything. And it basically took away our option to say, well, we're okay on that, maybe you shouldn't do it, but you know, we're not going to make a big issue out of it. Somebody else made a big issue. We had no choice then but to do what the statute says and follow through on it. Now, Mr. Grennison cited an attorney general opinion that said, well, hey, wait a minute. As long as you live in the county, that's good enough. You don't have to live in your district. And some of you read that in some of the materials that he provided, and I want Mr. Shepherd to address that also. And we're getting close to the end, by the way, here.
One of the first opinion, and Mr. Grennison had sent both of these opinions out. One was in 1971, and one was in 1985. And Mr. Grennison was relying on a case that was decided in 1876. Now, just being a layperson, do you think that the laws in Wisconsin might have changed a little bit from 1876? I don't know that you have to be a great student of the law to guess that probably that's happened in the last 100, 200 years, and certainly it has. And one of the big changes is the concept of equal representation. Those of you that were around here after the last census remember the redistricting process and the requirements of having to form 35 districts with equal population. Each supervisor has to represent equal number of citizens. So there are a number of statutes that talk about being elector of the district, being a resident of the district, and it's pretty accepted that you need to live in your district. Otherwise, what would prevent all supervisors from living in the city of La Crosse and representing the whole county? You rural supervisors may have a little trouble with that concept, but that's kind of the bottom line of that 1876 case, that you represent the entire county, which is true, and that judge said, well, residency isn't important. You live in the county, you represent the whole county, and that's fine. Well, equal representation has changed that idea quite a bit. In 71, the Attorney General, for some reason, kind of followed that line of reasoning and indicated that all you needed to, there was another argument about the use of the words for or from in the statute, and we talked about that with the judge a little bit, and he was kind of confused about that, as the rest of us were. But basically, in 1971, the Attorney General said, you know, you had to be in there in the district when you were elected, but afterwards, in 1985, the statutes have changed again, and the Attorney General, and this is, by the way, the second opinion that Mr. Grennison sent to us, and one of the provisions in this Attorney General's opinion says that any supervisor who moved from the supervisory district from which elected after June 1st, 1984, would vacate his or her office by reasons of Section 1703, sub 4 and 13. Those were the provisions on, you know, when a vacancy was created. And basically, the Attorney General in 1985 talked about it's up to the legislature to set the eligibility requirements, and the legislature has done that, and there's a recent case which I included in my memo to you, the Wellness case, which basically says if you move out of your district, you vacate. So the prior Attorney General's opinion and that prior 1876 case that Mr. Grennison cited are really not relevant law anymore. And I think that the conclusion is that you need to reside in your district. Now, certainly as referred to, there may be times when you are temporarily out of your district, taking a trip somewhere. But the point is that you've maintained a permanent residence inside your district. You have the intent to come back. And basically, it was the purpose of that evidentiary hearing that you were witnesses to on the 18th, for you to determine what the facts were and whether or not there was the intent and the physical presence of Mr. Erickson to reside in District 5, and I think your conclusion, at least 30 of you concluded that that wasn't so, that he had lied about his address in the 5th District, which I think was conclusively proved to not be a place that he ever resided in. That somebody mysteriously put his name on the post office box, if you recall that testimony, but nobody was claiming who did that, and I think that the testimony was clear that he didn't reside at that address. So, but that was the fact finding was basically within your province, and I think you determined those facts.
So, in the future, if some sort of an issue comes up, how will that be handled? Well, depends. If a verified complaint is filed with the county board, then, as was indicated, we don't have any choice. We're going to have a full hearing, the board, we're going to have a judge, we're going to have a court reporter, and so on and so forth. And then you can have a somewhat more limited in what kind of information I provide to the board so as not to cause that confusion. But what if it's simply an ethics complaint, or it is a complaint that may turn into a verified complaint, but the person hasn't put it into that format yet? In that regard, I will do what I have done before, which is to try to handle it informally. That happens more often than members of this board have any awareness of. I deal with those issues on a fairly regular basis, and I try to make them be resolved in a way that is acceptable to all parties concerned. Many of you know of a situation that happened last spring with a young man who was on the board that I think was handled very satisfactorily to all concerned, where he chose not to run again, and media had asked me about it, and they were satisfied that we resolved that one amongst ourselves, and that was the end of it. There have been other ones where questions have come up about particular board members where I've tried to talk to the other board member who had a complaint or a public citizen who had a complaint to try to resolve that, and have been pretty successful in that regard, and that would be my intent on how we would do that in the future. However, If it's a formal complaint, in other words, it's a written complaint, and I cannot resolve it informally to the satisfaction of all concerned, then it goes to whatever step is appropriate at that point. And that is not a decision that I would make in a vacuum. It's actually a decision that I would ask Corporation Counsel to give advice on. In other words, is it something that fits within the purview of the Ethics Committee? If so, it's going to go to them. Is it something that has to go to the full county board? Or is it something, some quirk that allows it to go to a particular committee or the executive committee or something like that? So what I have tried to do in this outline is to explain the process to show that from day one, there was a sensitivity to this being, number one, looked at as political, number two, unfair or lack of due process, and three, really bad publicity for the county board. I mean, this is not something that I enjoyed reading about in the paper or hearing about in the news. And so these were the decisions that we made. What I wanted to do today was to give you the explanation of why we made those particular decisions and to get feedback from the board in terms of concerns that you have, issues that I didn't address, ways that you think that we should have done things differently. So now is the chance for those kinds of comments. Does anybody have anything in that regard? Mr. Menninger.
Well, first, I've been kind of intrigued by that this order here in front of us. It's just a kind of silly, maybe, but when the vote is 31-0, it only adds up to 88.6%. It's the only time I understand the four abstentions are no, but when something voted unanimous, only in government can it be less than 100%. But my real question, though, my real question is I think I like Bobby. He sat next to me. Good kid. He was done wrong. He was a victim of his friends and his lawyer. They gave him bad advice. And my question isn't for your friends giving you bad advice, because friends do that all the time. But does a lawyer have to tell their client that their chances of winning are nothing? Or what's the job of a lawyer? I mean, we shouldn't have done that.
I'm here in my capacity as an elected official, but Mr. Shepard is here in his capacity as a lawyer, so I'll let him answer that question.
Well, I guess it's the responsibility of the lawyer is to give the client an objective view of the law, and it's up to the client to make a decision as to what direction he or she wants to go in. I can't tell you if what advice Mr. Gunnison gave his client. We don't know. Obviously, the decision was made to proceed, and whether or not he got bad advice, I guess that's for others to decide.
I decided.
Okay.
Any other comments anybody has to make before we move on? All right. Thank you very much. Let's go on to the next item on the agenda, which is the county farm presentation. And Kate Stalker is back with us to tell us where they're at.
Well, hi. It's nice to be back with you all tonight. This is going to be very lighthearted compared to where we've just been. I'm here to show you some pretty pictures and talk about what's been going on over the last many months. I think I was here last in March, maybe. It was quite a while ago. We completed our work back in the beginning of August, and due to lots of unforeseen circumstances, have been unable to get back here to talk to you since then. But I'm happy that I finally made it. And I'm going to try to recap very quickly because I don't want to revisit the whole presentation I made before. But we talked about the development of the county farm property as a sustainable development, economically sustainable, socially sustainable, meaning having people of all different ages able to live there, and being environmentally sustainable. And in order to do that, we wanted to create a property that was much more dense than most of the developments are in the county, or even in the state for that matter. It's sort of the trend, but we are on the cusp of that trend. Our instructions were to try to do something that would set the tone for future development in the county for land preservation. So we've created a development here that is much more dense than what you've seen before, but sort of harkens back to old small town life where you know your neighbors. I'm going to try to do this, but we may have technical difficulties. All right, Charlie, it's all yours. This was the area context map I showed you last time I was here, which shows the site between the highway and the railroad tracks and Lake Noshinok, West Salem to the west.
All right, Kate, I got to stop you.
That one?
Okay, Noshinok.
Noshinok, thank you. I know, I tell Charlie I say it wrong every time.
I say it wrong every time.
Adjacent to the Lakeview home and the new industrial park going into the south.
Business park.
But that was a change later. We've never changed the pronunciation of Noshinok, but we did change industrial park to business park.
Okay. So we had here the site analysis we went through before. The beige dashed lines are the ridge lines, although the site's very flat. The blue arrows show the flow of stormwater runoff as it rains. Although it's very flat, it does have particular patterns of flow. And then the solid beige there is the cliff, which represents slopes in excess of 12%, generally unbuildable. This is the final site plan. You have not seen this before. I came last time with three different concepts, and I'm here tonight to show you the final. We worked out with your county planner, and we have a lot of colors here, and I'm going to try to, I use this one, try to point out the colors here. This is the heavy business, formerly heavy industrial area of the site. This color represents light industrial or more business. The red is commercial. This plum color is senior housing. This blue is institutional, which would be schools. This orange is mixed use. That might be businesses on the first floor, apartments on the second, or retail on the first floor, businesses on the second. And then all of these different colors of yellow to cream represent residential uses in varying densities, the darkest yellow being the highest density, the lightest yellow being the lightest density, and the green, of course, is an area to be left in its natural state. First, we'll talk about the heavy industrial area. We have a slide here that shows... Oops, Charlie, can you go back one? The character of that part of the site. We have the institutional area, which would be all the schools, and we have a slide showing the character of that property. We've got the mixed use, and now from here on out, we're making it up. We're saying this is what we think it should be. We've got mixed use in here. These are some examples of other mixed-use communities I showed you when I was here last time. It can be anything, two stories, three stories, four stories, depending on how dense you want it to be. And mixed use only means more than one use in the building. So it can be a retail area if that's desired, with two floors of offices, or retail with offices with apartments, or condos over offices, any combination of things. But I would say probably in this area, two stories, perhaps three. And we have this commercial area, which would be not in place of any existing commercial areas, but would be commercial that would feed the neighborhood. So more things that people in this new neighborhood might need, a pizza place, a sub sandwich shop, a dry cleaners, a barber shop, an ice cream shop, that sort of thing. and we tried to create around it some open spaces to create like a town square feel. You can see in the upper left-hand corner places for people to gather. Charlie felt strongly when he saw these pictures of the existing or formerly existing county farm building, which are in the center and the lower right, that this would be a great nod to the past if we could create this little commercial area in the style of that building. And that is a beautiful building. You don't see many like that anymore. So we thought, what a great idea if we could incorporate that style of architecture to let people know that they're at this property and give some sort of historic significance. This is really the property immediately next door to that property on which this building sat. This is the area now of the Lakeview home, and the area we've colored here provides for expansion of the Lakeview home. And when we get back to the overall concept, you can see that this expansion of Lakeview is a considerably large-sized property and would allow for either apartment building towers, you know, multi-level buildings with elevators, assisted living, or independent living. It would also have plenty of room for independent living cottages. One thing we felt strongly about was that the people who live at the Lakeview home, while ambulatory, should have great proximity to this neighborhood commercial so that they can come down and walk through this area and see lots of people of varying ages. So this entire area was designed to provide for that adjacency between the two uses. This is the townhome residential area. We want to get the highest density of residential uses closest to the commercial area because those people will help support the businesses downtown. So we've got townhomes here. Can look any one of these styles. These are just some examples of what they could be. And then we've got our single-family residential area. Now, we've got lots of different styles here, and we've talked about going from the lowest density at 5 units an acre to the highest density at 15 units an acre, which is really dense and might be a fourplex building or something like that. And then everything in between, townhomes, duplexes, row houses, alley-loaded houses, and we've got quite a variety of those types of things. I'm sorry, Charlie. These are some examples of the single-family homes I showed you last time I was here, and also just a little illustration at the bottom there that shows what different densities mean on a standard city block, so you can get some idea. The home in the upper left-hand corner would be, of course, on one of the larger lots, and in the center on the right, center row, right two columns, you have something that's much higher density. And then we've got this vast open space network. When you take into account the village open space in the upper left-hand corner, we've proposed that we keep those steep slopes intact to avoid erosion, keep it natural, and have that be a county park. And then we get over to the lower right-hand area, that large oval shape, and that's an area currently used for detention. And Charlie feels that that'd be a great place for ball fields of all sorts. And while we didn't design that, we did throw in some soccer fields and softball baseball diamonds so that you can get a sense of scale. And then in the street pattern, we have these greenways you can see in front yards of houses, places where there could be a street, but we can also take the street out because the buildings are alley-fed from the back. So the front yards become the playground for the children. And there are many examples popping up throughout the country now of this. It's an old style of land use planning that's seeing a resurgence. And that gives people a way to safely bike to the county park or walk to the downtown. And so we create this linkage so kids can get safely back and forth to school. And then you can see, let me switch here. This green strip in here is between the commercial buildings in the commercial area. So that would be the town square area. And that little purple square is where the future water tower is going. And the blue square is where the cemetery is. And that lower center picture is Lake Neshonnik. Was I right? Yay! Thank you. And the other pictures are just illustrative of other open spaces and the way we see some of these open spaces being. Of course, there will be woodland paths in the county park. We'd love to see something like a gazebo in the town center, ball fields in the detention area, a splash play area in some common space in a neighborhood. And finally, I want to get to the cemetery. Now, this was not our charge to do anything with the cemetery, but it seems to me that that is the centerpiece of this property and of the history of this property. And as I'm sure you know, if most of you have been out there, there are very few headstones. There's not much there to designate it as a cemetery. And we felt strongly that in this new community, there should be a real sense of the history of what that cemetery represents. So we wanted to show you, and certainly there are hundreds of ways to do this, but we wanted to show you one way that you could make this cemetery into a place that people could be proud of and come to recognize the past. On the left there is a plat of the cemetery as it exists right now. And we envisioned some sort of a gate at the entry. And I'm going to show you here. We've had some discussions here about which graves are filled, and it's this section right in here. And the rest of it is empty. And according to Bill Young, he does not think that most of these on the right, or I'm sorry, on the left, will ever be filled, that perhaps 100 more in the next century, and that would mostly be up in this area here. So we wanted to offer that we think we have a plan for some sort of an illustrative walk where you would come in maybe and have little signs with quotes, something meaningful so that someone can kind of come through and recognizing that the people who lived here didn't have very much, but they used what they had to the best of their ability, that we would leave this part intact, of course, and these are the existing vehicular roadways, but we could create something using trees and benches and make a nice walkway through there, very formal. And this is the downtown over here, so this corner becomes very prominent. And if one were to walk up here, this is a future intersection. So if one were to walk up here, we could have some sort of a gazebo structure and some formal plantings, perhaps a pergola to walk under. And then throughout this cemetery, and I know it's difficult for you to see, right here is one, here at the end is one, some statues, monuments, common statues. And then we have a series of quotes we came up with. Well, we didn't come up with them. We just put them together. Famous people came up with them. That you could do, sort of break it out into three sections, some quotes about the people who were buried here. And maybe I went too fast there. You don't really need to read this. Charlie, I'll have copies if you'd like to see it. Something that would be sort of more introspective for people who are visiting. And some quotes about the journey of life. And finally, I wanted to leave you with a perspective drawing we did of this community, and we are looking from, this would be West Salem down here, and this is the business park. Here's the future water tower. This would be our commercial area. This would be the expansion of the Lakeview home. Here's the school campus. So you can see this road comes right around here, comes right into the commercial area. This is Garland Street, comes right to the commercial area. The cemetery is back here. This is the mixed-use buildings. And all of this, the high-density housing and the lower mid-level density and the low density out here, Charlie's house, right there. And all the ball fields right here for all those children he has.
For the grandchildren.
He'll make more.
And there's the site as it is now. So so anyway, I'm sorry I couldn't give you this when it was all fresh in your minds in August, but I'm glad I was finally able to come tonight and talk to you about it, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Tara Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure who this question is for, but it will be clear in my asking it that I haven't served on the board as long as Steve Doyle has. How is it that someone gets to be buried in that cemetery, that Bill is saying it would only be 100 over the next century?
I think there are people who lived at Lakeview, aren't they?
I can, maybe I'm not the right person to answer that, but I think I can. It was the people who lived in the Lakeview home and transients who passed through and died while they were in the county, had no one to bury them. Anyone who didn't have money for a funeral was buried here. So whether or not they lived at the Lakeview home, and still to this day, if someone were to die in the county and not have the money, they would be buried here.
So it's the old pauper cemetery. I mean, what
yes,
we used to
refer
to as pauper
cemetery. That is what it is, pre-welfare.
And the indigents, as we refer to it in human services, the indigents that the county is responsible
yes.
for burying get buried there.
Yes, and or somebody traveling through the county who is unnamed.
Okay, thank you.
Jerry Sobranek.
Thank you. You get an awful lot of green space here. It seems like the only thing anybody can ever think of is soccer fields, ballparks, and now gazebos. How much of all that green space, there's a lot of green space here, how much of that would be tillable for like a cash crop? I'm thinking along the lines of maybe switchgrass. You only plant it once every 10 years. You harvest it several times a year. That would be a good, it'd have aesthetic value, it'd have uniformity, and it could substantially lower down the Lacrosse County's operating budget.
Okay. Charlie, can you go back to the master plan? I think it's the second slide. Okay, there we go. The area all along the lake is the steep slopes of in excess of 12%, heavily wooded, not tillable. The detention area to the lower right, which is the largest area, holds water for a long time. I don't know what switchgrass's requirements are. Turf grass can last up to 48 hours submerged in water before it needs to be reseeded. I would think that it would be too wet for any sort of native prairie grass, but I don't know that absolutely. The thin green strips, the greenways between streets that lead from the business park to the lake, I think it wouldn't be viable just because of their size and shape. It's 60 feet wide.
Well, apparently then if it's, well, switchgrass will grow anywhere. It'll grow in sand. Dirt will grow anywhere. It'll go in the cracks of your sidewalks. But if it's too wet, then apparently you couldn't get in there to plant it, let alone harvest. Is that correct?
I would, and again, you'd have to talk to the county stormwater engineer, so I don't know what the requirements are for that detention area as it sits right now, or if it has additional capacity it doesn't need, but I would think that it would be problematic to get equipment in and out of it.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. What's the guesstimate of the amount of people that would live in this area when it's fully developed?
Oh, boy. That's a real good question.
Well,
Charlie,
I mean, if you have the densities and all that, you must have a rough guess.
Have you looked
Charlie,
at that?
Do you know it off the top of your head?
Approximately 1,000.
1,000?
And we have, maybe I should just refresh everyone's memory, we've from the beginning considered this workforce housing predominantly. We've got all these businesses located here. They need places to eat lunch. Restaurants who serve lunch cannot survive without homes coming for dinner. So in order to have a commercial area that's viable, you need to have all uses around it so that there are people to support it on the weekends, in the mornings, in the evenings. Our hope with this was that because of the higher density and the lower prices, that people could live in this neighborhood and one of them come to work in the business park, one of them go to work in the school, somebody go work at the Lakeview home, and nobody needs to drive.
And just to follow up, then, what is a workforce home?
That would be people like teachers, nurses, police officers, people who work in the community, who often in this day and age can't afford to live in the communities they work in. And so we provide homes that are lower cost for lower wages.
And that included the teachers?
Well, it could include the teachers. I don't know what the teachers make in West Salem.
We know they make a lot of money, especially in West Salem, right?
We seem to do all right.
Don Vina.
I thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we outpaid the teachers in the whole county when I was on the board years ago already, so that was no problem. About two or three questions. First of all, switchgrass came up, and I wouldn't plant switchgrass in the middle of a housing development, especially in a city where the kids could, you know, switchgrass gets 7 feet tall, and it don't grow in real good water wet land. But anyhow, I'd plant some other grasses before I go to switchgrass. I planted an acre and a half of switchgrass, so if you want to see what switchgrass looks like, come on up this summer. You talked about the multiple housing developments, mm-hmm. and you showed different scenarios, about five or six scenarios, mm-hmm. but you didn't show any housing developments that were joined, multiple housing in one house.
The townhome?
I'm not sure what you mean by townhome. That's what, two couples, or something?
No, townhomes are up to 10 units slammed together next to each other, and they're usually each two stories.
Okay, but you showed them individually on your slide, and that's why...
These are the townhome slides.
Okay, as long as they're combined,
yeah.
Because that's what they're going to out east.
Right.
Because of the problems with using up too much land.
Well, right. And the other thing, besides using up the land, the other thing is that city services, we have found with the type of development that's been customary in suburban U.S., with the big wide streets and the houses far apart, city services cost too much money. The garbage, the fire, the mail, that by putting people close together, you can reduce the taxes. So that's another benefit of going to something like this.
So, I read something into your slide that I shouldn't have then. You also have the school district, which did purchase some land from us, that put soccer fields in and whatever.
Yes.
And now you're showing a industrial, not an industrial, but a business park in between your projective ball fields and soccer fields and the school districts. Why didn't you put the soccer fields next to the school district? And then the kids wouldn't have to be running through traffic and...
Yep.
And whatever you have in that area.
Don, she couldn't move the bowl.
I can answer that.
There.
No, the bowl was way over on the other side. Were those ball fields in the bowl?
Yes, they
That's
were.
That's not and what I saw on your map.
Yeah, they were in it. And I can answer that by saying that we don't even know that the water sits for a short enough period of time in there to sustain that. That's just We put them in there so that you could see the scale of it, that it could be something like that. But that would have to be studied.
Well, I think you could pipe the water wherever you wanted to out there, because that's it's all fill, and all the sludge that came out of the lake is there now.
Yeah.
And that's pretty dry material. All you have to do is put a piping system in that takes it down into a. Back into the lake somehow.
Well, the stormwater engineers may not approve that.
But Charlie has a comment.
I don't know.
Don, yeah. If you look at this slide, where the word West Salem School District campus is, those are the West Salem soccer fields.
I know. I agree.
Okay.
I know. And
so the school district is building.
Okay, I thought you.
Right next to their soccer fields.
On your view of the development, it looked like it was right on the other side of where you could eat.
You're talking about over here. This is where we showed those ball fields.
And that's I got no problem with
and
that.
And that's in the bowl. But these are the existing fields here.
Yes, you're right.
Okay.
Okay.
And the rest is future expansion.
Brad Paff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as a spouse of a teacher, I can tell you that they're definitely not overpaid. What is the projected tax base of this area, industrial, commercial, residential? Because obviously we're all interested in growing the tax base.
Does our community development specialist have the answer to that?
Well, as we wait for that, I guess another question I have, and I did live in one of these townhouses in Washington, D.C., and definitely, I mean, there is density. But I also have been told by bankers, members of the Wisconsin Bankers Association, that trying to package and sell loans for houses that have been put together in high-density areas can be difficult. In fact, I was told that Fannie and Freddie, we've all heard about Fannie and Freddie, kind of were hesitant to buy loans that were in the higher density areas. Do you know of that? Is any of that true?
No, actually, I think that's completely false.
I'd like to hear that.
And certainly, a townhome is just a very luxurious condo with your own front door.
Their density, and there's a luxurious. Okay. One other quick question. Are there going to be multiple developers or one developer, or are we going to have...
I can answer that one, Brad.
Yeah.
To be determined.
To be determined.
By this board.
By this board. Okay.
Entire board, not a committee, this board.
All right. Thank you very much. And Brian, when you do get that information, just let me know.
$200 million is what Brian said.
Very good. Very good. Thank you, guys.
The MPAF.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to clear up a few things here.
The size of the village. I mean, that's what the density is significant.
I was just going to clear up a little bit on this here land that is being occupied right now. See, La Crosse County is renting that out as farmland right to date. And this here bowl part that you're talking about down here, that is, that's not tillable land anyway. So that really doesn't enter into the scheme of renting it out later. And one question I did have is, in the future now, we have about another 2 years of rental agreement with the renter that's there now, but will the Public Infrastructure Committee have the control of the rent, or will the Village of West Salem after this point for the next time around?
We still own it.
Yeah,
well, we will be continuing to
Jim Spropolis, our facilities director, is shaking his head. Yes, we still own it. We will continue to get the rent from it.
We will still be getting the rent. Okay, yes. Thank you.
Dennis, where is the village? You haven't seen this final version yet, right?
I have not. I had a couple questions, but yes, yours first, please.
Go ahead.
Way at the beginning of your presentation, you showed village lines that did not line up with reality. I assume you can fix those before you share this too much further. You had black lines and red lines and stuff like that. Okay,
yeah.
Well, that's done. Let's clean it up. Let's make it all black. Let's not have that kind of stuff on there. Point two, the village currently has two commercial districts. This makes three. The city of Unalaska has three commercial districts. I'm not sure we can support three. We have to be very, very careful when we talk about what commercial and retail you're going to put in there. We have a downtown now that is struggling mightily. We just got a grant announced, waiting for the money, that says we're going to revitalize downtown to the tune of like $800,000-$900,000. I don't think we want to revitalize downtown and have the one and only ice cream shop in town sit with no business.
I would heartily agree.
So you talk about commercial and retail. Mm-hmm. Be very, very careful what you talk about like that.
Well, it wouldn't be my decision what went in there, but I would think that the county might want to do a market analysis if and when they decide to build this, and a market analyst would tell you what the highest and best commercial uses are here, but the number of people that would be living here would support a retail area of that size.
We have 5,000 people in town now for the two business districts.
But you'd have 1,000 more. We've had this discussion in committee in terms of that commercial district should really be looked at as serving just that new development and not steal away from the downtown area. I mean, that would obviously be self-defeating.
Right, right. Another point, you talk about what kind of streets and alleys you're going to have in there. Whoever does this in the future, long after I'm not here, is going to have to worry about the village no longer picks up garbage on alleys. Mm-hmm. We got out of that business because we wrecked too many alleys and garages. And so if you don't have a street in front of the house, you think about where you want your people to carry their garbage cans to get picked up. Mm-hmm. It won't be in front of the house if you don't have a street, and it won't be in the alley. And they may not want to carry it to the end of the block.
Yeah, Madison is fighting that same battle right now, too, and some of the alleys have private service, and some are designed, and we designed these actually to those standards just because we know they work, a 28-foot wide alley that garbage trucks can come down just like a street.
So it becomes a street because we got streets that are 28 foot wide.
Yeah, right. Technically, well, the right-of-way is 28 feet.
So you put the street behind the garage instead of in front of the house.
Well, no, because the pavement's 18 feet, so that's not quite street width. But it's a 28-foot right-of-way as opposed to a 60-foot right-of-way that a street would have. But it's wide enough for any sort of fire or garbage truck to maneuver corners.
You bring up the other important point is it seems that fire trucks don't get smaller, they get bigger all the time.
Yeah. Well, the aerial ladders have the longest wheelbase of any vehicle, longer than a semi-trailer. So we have to design to those standards because even if there isn't a need for an aerial ladder truck in every community right now, someday there will be. And as density increases and buildings get taller, we have to make sure that the emergency vehicles can get through.
The other point is we currently have about 500 people or 450 people working in that business park, and not too many of them living right close by. So you still have to service those needs as well.
You know, I guess I should have shown you this. We have, and it's very difficult to see at this scale, but we have a road, a little tiny street that comes up through here, and a footpath that leads from this area up to this commercial area so that people can get there easily in a car or on foot.
One other point is long term, we will need, excuse me, we want second access across the railroad tracks for that area. Charlie and I have talked about that 17 times.
And I think Charlie's pointing where that would be. Just quietly.
That becomes part of the overall equation before it's done.
Yeah, that is a road we've got in there that's shown going to the tracks.
Because Charlie's development up there at Shorewood, you know, kind of got a bad crossing, Charlie. You need to.
So, back to my question, Dennis. What's the village's time frame in terms of looking at this? I mean, we obviously wanted to be partners with the village and not just say, here's what we're going to do and slam it through.
Our time frame is the last we heard from the county was the county was going to do nothing as far as residential development until the adjoining developments were done, a.k.a. Evenson and the duplexes along the interstate and whatever happens along County B. And that's probably 3, 4, 5 years down the road.
I guess mainly what we're interested in is to kind of bring some closure to this part of the process. for the village to say, yeah, we generally like the way you're going, or God, no, don't do that, you know, start over or whatever. I mean, just not a absolute, yes, we like exactly this, but to let us know if you think that we're moving in the right direction.
I think in the right direction. I think there'll be some disagreement as to where you draw the lines between business versus residential and how you make that division between there.
And we want to hear those things.
Because long term, you got railroad access along the interstate, and they don't have that throughout the rest of the county. We don't want to destroy that capability.
Okay. Okay. Don?
Well, you guys are raising questions in my mind now. Evidently, the village of West Salem was not in the discussion about this plan at all.
Very much so, they were.
Yeah. Were they? Oh, well, yeah. It didn't sound like it from the conversation here. And West Salem better be if this is going to be part of the village at some point in time.
They are. And Brian wants, he's anxiously waiting to add something.
I'd like to just say that I interviewed many people in West Salem. I did. And I know everyone else has had conversations as well.
I just wanted to clarify that exact point is this actual final concept plan that you're seeing is the plan that we did take to the village board the last time and kind of walked them through the concepts. This is a concept plan, and once we get it adopted as hopefully a concept plan, then it really becomes the next part of the process is then working with the village board and their planning committee to then work on the correct zoning classifications and work on, you know, but this is a planning tool. So it's trying to get buy-in to the overall concept of this. And, you know, so the village has, I think, Dennis, at the last meeting, we brought this concept to, and there seemed to be pretty good general buy-in and agreement with this.
With the same comments then we talked about now.
Exactly.
Any other questions? Jill Billings.
I'm wondering about the road that curves around the school ball field.
Mm-hmm.
It's between the
up here
village open space and the yeah. Do you foresee some sort of a pedestrian bridge or some way for? I'm just wondering how kids are going to get. I imagine they're going to be going across that road, and it seems like it's going to be pretty busy with traffic that feeds in from the green area and then up from the yellow area, too.
Yeah, that's a good question. In the last meeting, I know I told you that Schreiber Anderson is the contractor that the state hired to do safe routes to school for the state of Wisconsin, and we've applied all of those principles to this site so that it's designed with that in mind right up front. And we anticipate designated bike routes that use the residential streets to get there, and yes, with designated crossing to get across there over to the school campus. We don't want any children on bicycles on that main curved street over here, but we would bring them straight across in this way into the campus. How do they get from the school over here up to this open space? We have talked about having a bike path through here, but that would not be a safe route to school. You don't want children to use a secluded bike path like that. So our hope is that when children are going to and from school, they're using a more heavily populated area. But of course, there's access into this park right up in here, and there would have to be access straight through. I think there's one access here, and I think there's another one that exists right in here where we show that little purple finger sticking out.
Dennis?
What you got labeled as future county park up there actually is a current county park, South Shore County Park.
With a different size.
That might be, but there's a county park there.
That's right. But this is the future county park.
But you still have a county park there.
That's right.
John Menninger.
I was just going to say, if you take that marshy wetland area on the east side and put it on the west side, you could be talking about the mobile oil site.
Any other discussion? All right. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Those of you who have not gotten enough of this tonight are welcome to join us tomorrow morning at the Economic Development Fund meeting at 7:30, where we will also be talking about it. So. All right, that gets us to Sustainability Coordinator. Nick Nichols is going to tell us what he's been doing since we brought him on board. How many months ago has it been now?
Since June.
Since June, okay.
June 23rd. First of all, I'd like to thank everybody for allowing me to do this presentation tonight. I'm going to do a report, the first of what I hope will be many more, once my probation is over in June. Just to let you know, I think I'm going to be reading quite a bit off of my notes, just to let you know.
Just a second.
That's okay.
Sorry about that. Camera doesn't get him.
Is it getting my good side?
There you go.
Okay, once again. For too long, we've been hearing about all the bad news within the state about budget deficits, projected unemployment of 8%, and an economy that just keeps getting lower every day. Well, I'm here to give some good news. I'm the good news guy tonight. I'm going to be here telling you what's happening in the county and how we're saving tens of thousands of dollars by being more efficient and thinking about how we do our jobs every day. Sustainability isn't just the warm, green, fuzzy thing that's left over from the 60s. Sustainability today is real hard economics. And when you have people like Newt Gingrich, Pat Robertson, and the Reverend Al Sharpton working together, this has definitely transcended some boundaries, and everybody's working on it. I'm going to review the matrix that you got in your packet a couple of weeks ago. And I'm not going to review every item on there for the sake of time, unless you have specific questions on different jobs that I'm doing. But I want to go over some of the items that can show kind of how we're already getting payback on some of the projects that we're working on. I'll go over some of the other projects that some other departments are working on, and also bring up some goals that we're hoping to accomplish in the coming year. If you have any questions, concerns, or comments, or ideas about what we can do as far as sustainability in the county, please let me know. I am not the only one who's going to come up with these ideas, and I'm not the only one who's going to implement them. My goal, one of my big goals, is to help make La Crosse the most sustainable county we can be, hopefully saving us lots of resources, time, and, of course, the taxpayers' money. A little bit of background on myself. My wife and I have a little 7-acre spot of heaven in the town of Madary. We grow a lot of our own food organically. We raise a lot of our own eggs. I have about 25 laying hens. I have a 1.2 kilowatt solar electric system. I have a solar water system. And for those of you that were outside today in the 20-degree weather, my sunroom got up to about 72 degrees today, which was very nice. And if any of you would like to see some of the systems that I have or take a tour of what I've got, you're more than welcome to come on out. I'll give you the Nick tour. Usually that includes the beverage of your choice, too. I'm going to go over the matrix now. There's two sides. There's a short side, 30 to 90 day implementation once they're started, and then there's the long side, over 90 days. I'm going to go over the short side first. And then again, I'm not going to cover everything for the sake of time. If you have specific questions on specific tasks that we're trying to accomplish, you know, feel free to ask. Number one, the marketing, keeping local waste local. We just we had an article in the new Recycler, which I hope everyone got. We had one specific to sustainability. We also had one specific to our waste drop-off site, which is available to all residents in the county. They can bring material out to the landfill and drop it off anytime that we're open, 5 cents a pound, which is a real convenience for some people who have items that are larger than what they can pick up, or they want to get stuff out on another day. We're doing energy audits on some of our buildings. We've already done some preliminary audits and identified some opportunities for savings. Number three, our enhanced usage of the county drop-off site. I just mentioned that. Number four, the wood waste into mulch. This is one of my personal big successes. We worked out a deal with H&S Landscaping in Bangor where they were going to take some of our material out there. We were selling a lot of this material for $7.50 to Xcel Energy to use in their burner. H&S is buying it for around $20 a ton. Then we identified another company who would come out and take our material for nothing. Well, this saves us a $24 per ton shredding fee. We estimated that we could probably do this with 2,000 tons of material out to the landfill. That'd save us an estimated $48,000 a year. I'd say that's a pretty good deal. The sustainability website is up and running. This was created quite a bit by Tim Cabot and the IT departments of the city and the county. We're hoping to get some specific information on there about sustainability. We're doing recycling within the county office buildings now, thanks to Jim, who's helped set up quite a bit of that. Right now we're working on trying to get a confidentiality recycling program put together, too, to take care of a lot of our confidential materials. But this is saving us somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 a month right now, too. We're working on a chiller tune-up and a boiler tune-up program. Actually, Focus on Energy has this. You tune up your systems every year. They actually help reimburse you part of the cost. Any questions so far? I know I'm going through this kind of fast, but I know you've been here already quite a while. So, number eight, plasma gasification. This is an entirely new process that is available out there. It's not incineration. It's a process of taking a material, putting it into a vessel under high temperature with low oxygen. It basically disincorporates material into its molecular structure. We're taking a look at this as possibly being able to use it for disposing of a lot of our household hazardous waste, which we think it could be a lot cheaper, but it's going to take some investigation on our part to do that. And number nine, I'm working on trying to create a regular column within the La Crosse Tribune. So unless you have questions on the rest of those, on the short ones, I'll go to the long ones. Yes?
Did you say something about the 4-day work week?
4-day work week. Yes, I would. I think it's a great idea. this is one of the things we're looking at. We're getting some equipment from Focus on Energy where we're going to take a look at the amount of energy that we use within the county admin building over the course of every day of the week. And we're going to try and do some calculations as to what we might be able to save in energy as far as shutting down an extra day a week. And this isn't reduction in services. What we're talking about doing is expanding hours Monday through Thursday, say, and shutting down the extra day on Friday. Like I said, we're just looking at it just to get some ideas as far as information.
Tara?
I'm sorry, I don't want to take away from Nick, but is that part of a larger conversation, some work team or something, Mr. O'Malley, that larger group of people is
looking
at?
Exactly. A number of management team people have talked about it. A number of counties have examined it. This was an idea that has come out of sustainability efforts as well as budget-saving efforts. Whether or not we'd pursue that or bring you a recommendation on this obviously is a policy question, major policy issue, but at least we can examine what dollars might be involved if that were to happen.
Yeah, and I think it's great. I just want to make sure what Nick was doing was in concert with a bigger picture look
right.
at that
and,
concept.
And whether or not we go any further with that, we'll come back through
Thank
our process.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. The long stuff. Recycled asphalt shingles. As some of you may know, we've been collecting asphalt shingles out at the landfill for quite a while. We have quite a stockpile. This past September, we used approximately 79 tons in a road-based project out by the county fairgrounds. We used it in the first lift. Basically, that means it was the first layer of pavement that was laid down. And from what I understand, it worked fairly well. You know, it's not perfect, but this has been used around the country in several different sites, and we've gotten some good feedback on it. We're really hoping that we might be able to use more of this within our region. It's also a good way to offset some of the asphalt cost, which can help save us money. It can help save, like, Matthew Construction money. Plastics recycling, number three. This is something that I hope will come out of the Joint Oversight Committee on Sustainability, where the city and county can actually take a look at how we collect our waste, how we collect our recycling, and how we can make it as efficient as possible. Yes, sir.
I've got a question about that. Did
you speak to Xcel Energy on that? I thought they made a presentation here, and they like plastic in the waste stream because it burns at a higher temperature, and it got rid of some of the, they got emission levels and the stuff that isn't, supposed to be emitted. That they said plastic was actually good for them because it burned at a higher temperature, and it got rid of, otherwise they'd have to, use gas or something to raise the temperature to get rid of this emission problem.
Well, the amount of plastics that are normally recycled within a community are a very small part of what's actually out there as plastic. There's over 120 different types of plastics. The plastics that you can recycle are numbers 1 and 2, and that's it. And that's if you have a market. And anybody who's seen the economy lately has seen the markets drop for anything as far as recyclables. And there again, this would be part of the investigation. This would be part of the research that we would conduct to see whether that would have a significant impact. Burn barrels.
Jerry Sobranek.
I'm sorry.
Just a question while we're on this energy thing. I believe the governor's conference on energy is going to be in May, I believe. Are you working with that? Are you going to be a presenter? Are you attending? Are you going to have anything to do with the governor's conference on that?
I certainly hope I will. Will I, Steve? Yeah, and this is the first I've heard of it, too. I've been in contact with the Office of Energy Independence. I just attended a conference that was hosted by the Lieutenant Governor on climate change and what Wisconsin can do about it and how we can become more efficient. I'm aware of a lot of these projects and programs, and I'll be attending as many as I can possibly get to. Okay, burn barrels. Town of Holland and the Town of Onalaska recently passed ordinances banning burn barrels within their areas. I'm hoping to actually take this ordinance and some of the reasoning behind it and get these passed throughout the rest of the county. Two burn barrels can emit as much dioxin as our waste-to-energy plant over on French Island. That's pretty impressive when you're talking about the amount of dioxin that can be emitted. And we can make a huge difference in the amount of that type of material along with others that are out in the environment if we can eliminate burn barrels. Construction and demolition.
Joe Billings.
Can you tell me where burn barrels are allowed right now?
No, I can't.
Off the top of your head? No?
As far as I know, they're allowed wherever you want to put one. I don't think there's any kind of ordinance that prevents them.
Probably the incorporated areas would not allow it, but the unincorporated areas other than on Alaska and Holland probably would allow it. So any of the other towns?
Thanks.
Well, Charlie just let me know, too, that the state has an ordinance that does not allow them, but I don't think that stopped them from existing either.
No, I suggest you go to the towns association first before you try to impose ordinances, because the towns are the ones that have taken a stand on it. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I agree. Exactly. Yep. I agree. And if we could keep people to just burning, paper and cardboard and clean wood, there wouldn't be a problem. So, I won't be imposing any ordinances without specific authorization from towns. And exactly. All I'm doing is suggesting, and I'll be out talking. So, I would love to come to the town's town meeting, though. I am. I used to be a county employee over in Houston County. I've had my share of introduction to public service. Number 7, the Emerald Ash Borer. This is just something that we're taking a look at the current time because this may be a problem that we'll have to deal with somewhere down the line. And we'd like to be ahead of that curve before it hits here. Number 8, wind. It's my hope to offset all of the electrical use that the county has with wind turbines, if I could do it. Anyway, any other questions on those? Otherwise, I have a couple other items I'd like to go through quick.
Yes, Dina?
Well, I read through your list and I made comments, and you covered most of the answers already, so you did a pretty good job.
Thank you.
Why aren't you looking at the gas coming off of our landfill? There's a lots of landfills smaller than ours around the state and country that capture the gas and heat houses next to or a business next to the landfill. it just seems like that's the logical thing, because we are burning a lot of gas coming off of that landfill, and now that we got a new one going in and we're all set, why can't we capture that gas and do something with it? You know, Heilman Brewery are...
Wait, Don. Give him a chance to answer.
Well,
he has an answer.
Well, I'm sure he does, but I was just saying...
Give him a chance to give it then.
After all of these years, Heilman Brewery is going to do something with their heat down here now.
He knows a lot about that.
Okay, good. Because...
Don, let him answer.
Actually, I was behind the idea of using that flame over at the Heilman Brewery with Gunderson Lutheran when I worked there. And we have been discussing what we might be able to do with that flame out at the landfill. Right now, we are at the very minimum amount of gas production that you can use in order to be able to use it for anything, like creating energy or using it as a heat production. And it's kind of inconsistent. It needs to be at a certain level before you can actually incorporate some type of machinery in order to use it. We're hoping within the next couple of years to be able to use that gas and the increase in production, because they moved the old cell into the new cell, and hopefully be able to use that. So we are looking at that. Just because it's not on the matrix doesn't mean we're not looking at things. This is just an outline of some of the projects that we're looking at. And like I said, if you have other ideas, and this is certainly a good one, make sure you get them out here so that we can take a look at whatever might work for our county.
Jill Billings.
Could you please tell me about number 5, C&D ordinance? I don't know what C&D stands for.
Oh, I'm sorry. I covered it kind of quick. It's a construction and demolition ordinance, and this is something that I've talked with Tim Cabot and Larry Kirsch from the city on, as far as trying to incorporate a requirement to recycle a certain percentage of construction and demolition material. The university right now is looking at the possibility of tearing down 3 buildings. If we can require a certain amount of that material get recycled, it keeps a certain amount of material out of the landfill, which is our big goal. And so this is something we're just talking about right now. There's nothing coming down the pike right now.
Other questions or comments for Nick? All right. Thank you, sir.
I got
more.
Something else I want to cover.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I put together just a few other items that I didn't get onto my matrix here that I wanted to make sure you heard about. Again, I wanted to give out some good news tonight as far as what's being done in the realm of sustainability and by the employees and staff that work for the county. I think you should be very proud of the work that some of these guys are doing, guys and gals, excuse me. Just to let you know, Wisconsin Technical College, the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, and Viterbo University each have established sustainability groups, and Gunderson Lutheran has hired a new sustainability coordinator. So this is really hitting the mainstream as far as organizations trying to work to save money within their groups. Our own purchasing department helped develop an environmentally preferable purchasing policy. That means we will take a look at the environment also and the impact that items have on the environment before we buy them, along with the economics. We started using microfiber mops at Lakeview and Hillview. These are just mops that I should have brought an example. They're kind of hard to describe, but they're not like the old rag mops that we use. They use a lot less water and a lot less chemical to do the same job. We estimate we can save somewhere in the neighborhood of 39,000 gallons of water a year just by using these, and somewhere in the neighborhood of $3,200. It also helps reduce labor costs. And what I mean by that is that people, instead of mopping floors, can go out doing more important work at Lakeview and Hillview. We've been using Ecolab for our laundry services at Lakeview and Hillview. Because of them, we're using 32 gallons of water less per load on about 2,500 loads per month. That translates into 960,000 gallons of water that we're saving per year. Yeah, and that's heated water, too. I don't have numbers as far as how much money we're going to save on that, but I'll have those for our next report. IT, information technology, has set up an automatic shutdown program for our computers. We're estimating we can save $60,000 a year just by doing this. Just by turning the computers off. Yeah, we should all do this in our homes, too, by the way, just to let you know. They're also working on another effort to reduce the number of printers we have, which will save us somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000 a year. We just received 1,124 compact fluorescent light bulbs from Focus on Energy for nothing. They had a program where they overordered, and instead of paying for a restocking fee, they were giving them out to cities and counties, and I got us about 1,100 of these. They'll save us an initial cost of somewhere in the neighborhood of $3,372, saving 180,964 kilowatt hours per year. That's about $12,670 a year, just by putting in compact fluorescent light bulbs. A lot of these will go in Hillview, Lakeview, and Carroll Heights. IT also helped set up our conference room with remote conferencing next door, so we can take advantage of training sessions without having to travel. That'll save us some other money. So almost $100,000 in savings were identified and implemented just in the last 6 months. And, you know, if you see your county employees out there, you know, pat them on the back. They're doing good work. And it's nice to know that. Just a few other goals, then I'll be done.
It's okay.
We're looking at installing credit and debit card use in several of our departments, including solid waste. We really need that. Virtual billing for vendors instead of making out paper billings. We're talking about working on a community car program with an outfit out of Madison that employees and staff would be able to use. We're piloting a project with a neighborhood electric vehicle this spring, which ought to be kind of interesting. We'll see how that works. And then our joint city-county strategic plan should be coming to the board hopefully next month. So a lot of good stuff going on out there. There again, call me anytime if you want to take a tour, if you have questions, comments, or you just want to sit down and talk sustainability. Thank you.
Any other questions for Nick? Ralph?
On that wind, number 8?
Yes.
Is that a wind farm, or what is that?
It's whatever I can get.
I mean, it isn't a system that sits on top of the buildings that generates electricity, or is it out in the rural areas?
We're probably looking at something that would be substantial, like a wind farm in someplace that would have a good wind production. That would not be anywhere here in the valley.
Brad Paff?
More of a comment than a question. I have known Nick for over 4 years, and I tell you, this guy lives what he says. You know, he and his wife and their children believe this. I mean, they've demonstrated the economics behind the energy savings that they do. I would encourage you to do a tour of the man's home. It is, well, anyway, he's a very interesting guy. I applaud Steve O'Malley and the county for bringing you on, and I do look forward to continuing to work with you on this and other projects. So good job.
Well, the kids have not always been willing participants. Thank you.
Anybody else? All right. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
All right. The Sustainability Strategic Plan, I understand, is going to be held over till next month. Is that correct, Jay?
Correct. Okay. I was just going to say, nice job, Nick, and we anticipated having a finished plan document for you this evening. We do not, so I'm asking for a 30-day referral
to
the February
cycle.
You'll
keep us in suspense until next time.
That's right, although you've heard a lot of it tonight, so. No,
that's good.
Just enough to titillate you, you know.
All right. Let's see, future agenda items. Anybody have any? I have a couple of, go ahead, Ralph.
Well, I don't know. When we need it, we don't need it immediately, but we should get an update on some of these lawsuits. You know, I see in the paper somebody died of natural causes and stuff. I don't know what that means, but I don't know if that's open or closed or whatever. I don't need it next month, but in the next two or three, it seems like we have multiple things. I don't know if that's open or closed or whatever, but whenever we have a light agenda, throw it on. I don't care if it's done in March or April or whatever.
Oh yeah, next time we have a light agenda, we'll get right on that. But I think that's good that we should bring the board up to speed on those things. Margaret Wood.
Are there any other supervisors besides myself and Ralph that want a little bit more information about a substantial fiduciary relationship before we go tonight? On this thing we're supposed to sign? I mean, is this like our portfolios, or only if we have ownership in a business, or do I have to go read that green book?
No. Bill can comment on that.
Can you?
Let me see the. I see the.
What number is that on there, Margaret?
It's the first paragraph after Code of Ethics Statement. The beginning, I have the following substantial fiduciary relationships. Sounds really exciting.
It's not this one. You're not reading the same thing he's looking at.
It's the second.
It's the under the dark print.
Like, for instance, I own stocks in
oh.
West.
There's this one.
Sell, they're going bad.
There we go.
Right. And
don't take stock advice from me. Two pieces of advice.
Well, I think that the amount, the 10% ownership or $5,000 is the guideline.
So if I have mutual funds,
stocks?
I have no idea how much.
Mutual funds, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think we're concerned about that. Basically, what we're trying to get information, you know, businesses that would do business with La Crosse County. Mutual funds.
I think the confusion is
I agree.
If you
I
get
don't know what
a mutual
mine are
fund
either.
Or a... some kind of tax-deferred stuff, you get these statements that say dividend reinvestment. You don't think of yourself as a shareholder, but it says dividend reinvestment. It doesn't say interest. You get interest on a separate line item, but it'll say dividend reinvestment. So does that mean anything?
If you have it as part of a mutual fund, I don't think that's a problem. The bigger concern would be if you have individual shares of stock with somebody that does business with the county. That's really more what they're looking at. But if you have on your specific situation a question about, hey, am I covered, and you want to confidentially ask Bill, that would be the way to do it. Just say, okay, here's what I got, Bill. Tell me if this is an issue. And then you get a clear answer from him, and you don't have to tell the world what you've got if it's not going to be a conflict. So.
And also, if I give you advice and it's wrong, you're protected. So it's a pass.
All right. Two reminders, those conflict forms, please turn those in if you have not done so yet. Next,
I give away your form.
I think most of you know about this, but a reminder, a retirement party for our former county clerk, Marion Nagley, is this Friday at, what's it called, Boot Hill? Boot Hill Pub. Right by the rubber mills, I guess. So what time does that start? Right after 5 o'clock. So certainly encourage people to attend that if you are available.
It's by the CMO.
By the CMO? Okay. Pardon?
Friday the 16th, night of the 16th.
So that's the following Friday then. Okay, at Loon's on La Crosse Street. Ray Ebert? People have been doing that. If you have not done it yet, does it by? Okay, good point. Okay, anybody else? Any announcements, questions, comments, concerns? Is there a motion to adjourn? By Arlene, second by Jerry Sobranek. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. Carried unanimously.